And Focus continues here on News Radio KMAN. And for the next half hour or so, we're going to be talking with Dr. Stephen Higgs from the Biosecurity Research Institute. Good morning.
Good morning, Brandon. Good to be with you again. And great to hear Dave back on the radio and sounding well.
Yes, it's great. We're full strength finally here on the news team. And Dave's going to say a few words, I think, here.
Why, thank you, sir. This is I feel as good today as I have in weeks.
That is splendid. Strength to strength.
No kidding. Not 100%, but definitely improved. Thank you for your comments.
All right. Well, you're normally 110%, so if you've dropped a bit, maybe you're back to 100.
Yeah, maybe a bit.
You know, we actually now all three have something in common. We've all three had the coronavirus. So
yeah, that's true.
Last time I spoke to you, that was not the case. So,
no.
But it's interesting. Obviously, the coronavirus has dominated our news cycle here the entire year, and it's encouraging that we're seeing vaccines here. I might just have you comment a little bit about that, and how fascinating it is that we talked a few months ago, and it looked like it was months, maybe a couple years down the road, we could have a vaccine, but now we have one.
Yeah, here it is. It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, with others in the pipeline, getting close. So we've got alternatives.
People hear about that, and it takes a long time sometimes for vaccines to come to fruition. But can you talk about just the magnitude this has on science right now? Because I know Dave's talking on the First Light Show this morning. They were comparing it to, you know, the man going to the moon.
Yeah, almost, I suppose. This is kind of a new technology, the ones that we are seeing based on mRNA. So that's kind of a new technology to get into the vaccine platform for people. But, the process for normal vaccine development can take years, literally. The one exception to that was the sort of emergency authorization for an Ebola vaccine, which was obviously killing thousands and thousands of people with and very high fatality rates. So that was kind of accelerated. And now here we are with these new SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19 vaccines being accelerated also. And it's good to see those becoming available. And I think they're being distributed to every state from what I've read this morning already.
Yeah. Well, it is fascinating. You know, the thing with Ebola and with COVID-19 is not everybody got the vaccine for Ebola. Like, I don't remember getting one. But this is a challenge now, getting as many people vaccinated as possible, because, as I understand, that's the best way that this is going to be effective.
Yes, the more people that are protected, then the better, obviously, because there's fewer susceptibles to maintain the epidemic that's ongoing. Of course, you, I, and Dave, I don't know whether you've had the antibody test, but I did subsequently. And so I don't need the vaccine. I've got good antibody levels already.
Perfect. Well, that's good news. No, I have not had that yet, but that's certainly maybe something for down the road. Well, it's obviously good news that we're reporting on that. Are you surprised that it happened this quickly?
I am, but, all the stops were pulled out, the technology and the platforms were there. Being molecular based, it's a much quicker process and very adaptable, compared with some more traditional, vaccine measures. We assume that they've done the necessary testing procedures, probably not in all cohorts of different types of people. So, you know, you have some vaccines that also have to be tested in children and in pregnant women and so forth. That may not have been done yet, but I assume that if it's been approved, one certainly hopes if these have been approved, that it's met all of those expectations for safety and effectiveness.
Yeah. Well, it's obviously, there's going to be some skeptics out there who may have thought it was a little bit rushed, but, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some other things going on here with the Biosecurity Research Institute. I understand you recently testified in front of Senate, but not actually in D.C.
No, that's right. So, I mean, it's a tremendous privilege and honor to be invited to testify in front of a Senate committee. This was the committee on agriculture, nutrition, and forestry on December 2nd. You know, part of the joy of that was that this was Senator Roberts' last meeting on that committee as chairman. Not the joy that it was his last meeting, of course, but to hear all the accolades. You know, one of the good things, I mean, we see obviously party politics, but not in a committee like that. You know, both parties come together and realize that this is important for America as a whole, for all of our citizens, to protect our agriculture, nutrition, and forestry, and our food supply, obviously. So there, it really is apolitical, bipartisan, where people come together for the greater good. That sounds glib, doesn't it? But you know, and Senator Roberts has just done a phenomenal job, and politicians from both sides, members of that committee, were just so sincere in their recognition of his contribution. He'll be much missed.
Yeah, he definitely will. He's done a lot for agriculture out here, and obviously he's got a building name for him there on campus.
Yeah, we happen to have a building, and we happen to have the Biosecurity Research Institute in that because of what he's done and because of him raising awareness of threats to agriculture. The purpose of that meeting was to discuss and highlight the importance of research. I mean, the BRI is research, education, and training. But this was an opportunity to answer questions and to make a testimony on why research is so important. And obviously, I was not shy about highlighting the BRI in Pat Roberts Hall and providing examples of what we're doing. And obviously, as you know, most recently, several COVID-19 related projects.
That's right. Can we talk about some of those that are ongoing right now?
Sure. So as you know, I mean, a lot of the university was, for good reason, being closed down in March. The BRI is a facility that I sort of jokingly say, you can't turn the lights off and put the key under the mat and say, you know, gone to lunch. This is a facility that is so sophisticated that we really have to have it more or less fully staffed all the time. Because if you do shut a facility like this, even partially down, bringing it back up to speed is safety and security is an issue. And we've got, you know, phenomenal staff that do this. So while a lot of the people on campus were working at home, we basically were rotating staff through and not even down to a skeleton force and keeping the place running. And the university designated that research on SARS-CoV-2 was mission critical. So we were able to adapt very, very quickly and get researchers in with the right expertise to start doing research. I mean, we hardly missed a heartbeat, to be honest, in terms of the momentum. So we've talked about some of this research before, Brandon. We did the mosquito work that proved that this virus couldn't be transmitted by mosquitoes. And then Dr. Raitt has done research on swine, which are not susceptible to the virus, on cats, which are susceptible, don't develop symptoms, but do shed the virus. And then recently on hamsters, you know, for traditional vaccine work and for studying pathogenicity, how dangerous this virus is and how it interacts with the body, you need small animal models. Ultimately, these vaccines get tested in non-human primates, but initially you want small animal models, and they've been working on hamsters. We've had, I don't know how many publications out. We've had a lot of publications from that research based at the BRI already this year, so we're getting the information out there. the mosquito stuff was published, the pigs and the cats, and I presume the hamster work is being written up or is already submitted and going through the review process.
Yeah, and I think we spoke about some of those on our last show, but yeah, and the people can go read that. You probably have those linked on the BRI website.
Surprisingly, you're absolutely right. Yes, we do. Yeah, just go into the BRI website, and you can call those up.
I think it's fascinating. Yeah, all the research that has gone on. You know, we've learned a lot about coronavirus in 9 months. You know, it's been
remarkable.
Yeah, but you know, I think early on, folks were wondering, you know, can I transfer this to my cat? Now we know, no, you cannot. you know, they can't. You can't get it from your cat. I suppose maybe that's the correct way of saying it here, but because early on, I mean, people were really scared of this virus, and maybe rightfully so. We have people wiping down surfaces constantly, still doing that here.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. And, you know, with regards to the cats, they do shed the virus, so they are a source, but it seems relatively rare that they are naturally infected. So it's not like they're a highly significant threat to people, to owners.
I think the mosquito thing is big, though, because that, you know, you could see that being a real problem because mosquitoes transmit all kinds of diseases.
Yes. Yeah, they do. You know, there are millions of people get infected every year with viruses transmitted by mosquitoes, and they kind of bite indiscriminately. There seem to be some people who are more attractive than others to mosquitoes, as we know, but typically mosquitoes bite, you know, people of all ages, for example. So the fact that they do not transmit this virus is a great relief. It would be even worse than it currently is.
You know, speaking with Dr. Stephen Higgs, he's the director of the Biosecurity Research Institute at Kansas State University. And we're going to pause here. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll come back and talk some more. If you've got any questions, give us a call, 785-537-1350. In Focus continues after this.